You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
This is Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Richard Ford, the author, most recently, of Independence Day. It's a sequel of sorts to an earlier book called The Sports Writer. He's the author as well of a book of short stories called Rock Springs and three other novels, including The Ultimate Good Luck and Wildlife. You know, I think that this is such an extraordinary book, and
thanks.
I took enormous pleasure and astonishment in the course of reading it. I wondered, and I've never really asked this before, how did you know you could do it?
Well, I actually thought I could do it. And when I hear myself say that, I can hear my wife saying to me about her own life. She sometimes says, you know, in her life, she's a city planner. She says, for me a day, she says, is just wondering if I'm going to have time to do the things that I know I can do. She says, for you, you don't even know what you're going to do that day. You're kind of always plunging off into the, well, I don't want to call it the darkness because it isn't darkness, into the unknown, say. But I actually never thought that if I just stayed my course, that I couldn't write almost exactly this book for whatever are its virtues and frailties. I knew I wanted it to be a funny book, and I knew what I wanted it to be about. And although I made some wonderful for myself discoveries in writing it, it pretty much approximates what I thought it would be, which isn't to say it didn't give me a month and 3 years of anxieties and the usual kinds of ups and downs of writing a long book and working every day. But it never became a thing. Indeed, it never became less of a thing than I hoped it would be.
Well, it's the story of a weekend in the life of Frank Bascom, who's now a realtor. But what impressed me particularly about it is that, you know how sometimes during the course of an otherwise normal day, you understand life or something about yourself, but usually only for around 15 to 45 seconds.
Yes.
The understanding and its fleetingness seem to last the duration of this book. He seems to go in and out of some kind of understanding that the way he feels now is not the way he'll feel 15 minutes from now or the way he felt a half an hour ago. And so his thoughts are always evanescing in anticipation of what's coming and in half recollection of what's come before.
Exactly. Well, it's a book, so in that way, it doesn't try to imitate life. Because I don't think we do that in life. I think we, as you said, we have a few fleeting 15-second intervals of clarity, and then the rest of the world kind of, you know, like a wave caves in on top of us, and we go on with whatever we're doing. But I mean, by saying it's a book, what I mean is that it's a made thing, and it means to refer to life and not really to imitate it. So many things that occur in books, conventions within books, epiphanies, for instance. Nobody really ever has much of an epiphany in life, but it's a convention of a book or a contrivance of a book which says to us, here, pay attention to me. You may, even though this is dissimilar to life, you may find something in it which will take you back to that life of yours with profit. So the fact that it has this effect as a book is an effect of its madeness.
Well, but part of its madeness, and this is odd because, you know, you find yourself reading a book and then you read a description of the book in a review. And I would think that is almost ecstatic as the reviews of this book have been, they've none of them described the book I read.
Nor the one I wrote. There were a couple who seemed to describe the larger lineaments of the book that I wrote, having mostly to do with conceding that it's a funny book.
Uh-huh. But at the same time, for instance, when Frank hears from his son, Paul, that Paul's having problems, and one of his problems is that he's not just thinking, he's thinking about thinking.
Yeah.
Which is, in a way, what Frank spends most of his time doing, so it seems genetically likely that his son will too, and started too early on that it may feel like having the flu permanently.
Exactly.
And toward the end of the book, Frank leans close to him and says, "Are you thinking about thinking?" And he says in his hospital bed, "No, I think I'm just thinking." And there's something very satisfying about the way in which very common phrases have been weighted in this book so that they arrest the heart and meaning and alter it and torque it.
I mean, probably all books are about this, and this particular book is certainly about it. It's about trying to find an adequate language for the simple, ongoing, everyday way that you, and complicated way that you feel about life. Trying to find the lingo, the right words, and not only just to find the right words, but to find usable words for thinking your thinking. I mean, I think everybody's had a moment when they realized that they were thinking they were thinking, which they were slightly set off from their thinking process and were watching it happen.
Yes, but what's unusual here is that there's a kind of acrobatic assault. Most books in which people think about thinking are very abstract books.
Yeah.
What's unusual here is that this is a person who's very involved with the nuts and bolts of real estate and life and transient gestures between people. The concrete is loved by him, possibly so much that this is why he feels alienated. Most alienated people, I think, it's not that they're spurning life, it's that life never generates intensities equal to their own feelings.
Or their needs. Right.
So here in the midst of this nuts and bolts world, there is a consciousness being built in the prose, and oddly that consciousness gets doubled by this talk about real estate and houses and the way people live and what shelters them and what makes them feel secure. So the book has both a physical landscape and an internalized one, and it's simultaneous.
For me, that's I guess that's why Emerson is in his own way kind of important to me, because I couldn't write a book that started off with ideas. I'm just not smart enough. I'm not trained well enough. But I do know that they exist, and that attention to details can sometimes lead you to a view of the world which is somewhat more organized than the details give immediate appearances of. So I wouldn't write a book that didn't start off with a sort of a rapture of details, with a affection and ultimate affiliation with whatever is, you know, concrete. I would hope, by looking at those things for a long time and putting words in people's mouths and moving them around an illusory landscape, that I would be able to organize a book which would point towards something else which might be worth knowing, but that I could never have done the other. That's why in the book, when Frank tries to get his son Paul to read Self-Reliance and also to read the Declaration of Independence, it's such a piece of absurdity, because the kid's, you know, on another level of experience. And indeed, Frank's on another level of experience. He's just at his wit's end with his kid to know how to speak to him, so he gives him a book. But it's perfectly ridiculous to try to do that. They're both in the world.
Now tell me, where did you get, collect, assemble Frank's lingo from?
I mean, it's lingo about how he describes his own mental processes.
No, I mean, you know, in the simple act of reading this book, the words oddly call attention to themselves. Mm-hmm. For instance, someone speaks about writing a training manual of some kind, and Frank speaks about, you know, the book catching on with the DIY crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And you think to yourself, DIY, and then you hit, oh, do it yourself. But the book seems to be made out of all of these received bits of common language that you have to think for a second to assemble, and that's what gives it both an immediate tone and a distanced one at the same time. And I thought, well, do you have a box full?
Well, I have a head full of them anyway.
Uh-huh.
I know you're a devotee of William Gass. Well, so was I a devotee of William Gass and long ago. And I think it was through reading Gass and reading what Gass wrote about fictions that I came to think that words, and I could have found it someplace else, I came to think that words were interesting for themselves and that they carried an emotional weight which was almost which was almost in there of avoirdupois, you know. It had not so much in what they necessarily referred to, but you see a word on the page. And so I think that it's pleasurable to see words on the page, and that and for instance, every time I would write Great Falls, Montana, in some story that I wrote, it gave me huge pleasure, maybe even long before I went there. So I'm trying to put words on the page, which in and of themselves have a heft and have a cadence, which I think will make a sentence a more pleasurable experience. And then once I get them in the sentence, for reasons that have to do not always with their cognitive value, then I try to invent a cognitive use for them within it.
Well, I like in particular, as I was reading, noticing, you know, that Bascom comes from Haddam, mm-hmm. and the couple that he takes around, what are their names?
The Markhams.
Yeah, the conjunction of words ending with M,
yeah.
gives a kind of odd pleasure in the same way, too, that paragraphs in the book that might otherwise be a novel's mood music driving mm-hmm. through towns and setting up of streets become in this book oddly the kind of song of the consciousness of the book.
And I think that's exactly right. I mean, I'm determined not to treat you to a paragraph in the book that I haven't tried to make as full as I can make it, and not necessarily in that way, as you said before, the meaning of the book. But I want that music within paragraphs to be always there, even if the book's not doing very much. I mean, somebody said to me once about Haddam, New Jersey, this fictitious place I invented. Did you put that in the book because there is a line in The Wasteland which Eliot refers to, O Men of Haddam? And I said, no, I just put it in there because it started with an H and had two syllables and ended in an M. So that's the kind of music that I'm always trying to make in a paragraph. If it's something just passing you from one place to another, or if it's something holding the most important, so to say, substance of the book, I want it, in essence, to be musical, to sing.
I wanted, I guess,
whether I succeed or not, by the way.
I guess this would be an appropriate place to suggest talking about the mood music of the book. I'm going to ask you to read a page from it. This finds Frank Bascom in bed. He's in the spare room at his girlfriend's house. He's just had the sudden fear that perhaps someone else occupies this room from time to time, and he winces. This is Richard Ford reading from his novel Independence Day.
There are winces, of course, and there are other winces. There is the love wince, the shudder often with accompanying animal groan, of hot rivet sex imagined, followed frequently by a sense of loss thick enough to upholster a sofa. There is the grief wince, the one you experience in bed at 5 a.m. when the phone rings and some stranger tells you your mother or your first son has regretfully expired. This is normally attended by a chest-emptying sorrow, which is almost like relief, but not quite. There is the wince of fury when your neighbor's Irish setter, Prince Sterling, has been barking at squirrel shadows for months, night after night, keeping you awake and in an agitation verging on dementia, though unexpectedly you confront the neighbor at the end of his driveway at dusk, only to be told you're blowing the whole dog-barking thing way out of proportion, that you're too tightly wrapped and need to smell the roses. The wince is often followed by a shot to the chops and can also be called the Billy Budd. What I have just suffered, though, is none of these and has left me lightheaded and tingling as if an electrical charge had been administered via terminals strapped to my neck. Black spots wander my vision. My ears feel as though glass tumblers were pressed over them. But then, just as quickly, I hear the beach voices again, the slap of a book being closed, a feathery laugh, somebody's sandy sandals being slapped together, a palm being smacked on someone's tender red back, and the searing owie while the tide fondly chides the ever-retreating shingle. What I feel rising in me now, a consequence of my big-time wince, is a strange curiosity as to what exactly in the hell I'm doing here, and its stern companion sensation that I really ought to be somewhere else. Though where? Where I'm wanted more than just expected, where I fit in better, where I'm more purely ecstatic and not just glad. At least someplace where meeting the terms, conditions, and limitations set on life are not front and center, where the rules are not the game. Time was when a moment like this one, stretched out in a cool, inviting house, not my own, drifting toward a nap, but also thrillingly awaiting the arrival of a sweet, wonderful, and sympathetic visitor eager to provide what I need because she needs it too. Time was when this state was the best damn feeling on God's earth. In fact, was the very feeling the word life was coined for, plus all the more intoxicating and delectable, because I recognized it even as it was happening and knew with certainty no one else did or could, so that I could have it all to myself the way I had nothing else.
Richard Ford reading from his most recent novel, Independence Day. I'm curious what you feel influenced your sentences.
Boy. Well, probably a rather non-stylistic concern, which is to make them as full as possible. I really felt that to have written this many books and to be still out there asking readers to quit watching, you know, reruns of Bonanza, I had to offer something. And what I wanted to offer was a surfeite of language and experience. And not just simply in surfeite. I wanted it to be in behalf of something important. So I wanted full sentences, and I was willing to make long sentences, and I wanted them to somehow circle continually back around to things that were important. So probably that's what a wish to give some, to give a lot is what influenced those sentences.
Well, let's talk about comedy now. I want to make sure, since we share this admiration, that somewhere in here we tip our hat to Charles Portis, the wonderful writer of Norwood and True Grit and Masters of Atlantis, and one of the real contemporary masters of American humor and much more as well. But you've got a kind of comic rhythm here that sometimes is only exemplified by shticks, but I laughed out loud by the man who wishes he came from a place and not an area.
Right. And I did too, actually. There are some pleasures in writing novels, and one of the pleasures in writing novels is tickling yourself, amusing, making yourself laugh. And that made me laugh. I don't know. When I thought of it, it made me laugh. And when I wrote it in the book, it made me laugh.
Can you, whose comic tones do you admire the most?
Stanley Elkin.
Oh, I heard The Franchiser here somehow.
Walker Percy. I like the aside. I like it in a sentence when you're talking about something, and then you kind of turn aside and put it in parenthesis in the sentence and speak to the reader as though to say, and then there's this. Oh, by the way, which is I think a comic contrivance within a sentence. And to me, it's irresistible. The sports writer has it. This book has it in spades. In fact, I had to take a few out. I think I was finally amusing myself more than I was amusing in behalf of the book. But Stanley, I mean, my God, and it's worthwhile saying so too, since Stanley just died. Another guy like Bud Porter's, who hugely influential to his generation and to mine, and who maybe never got sung enough to praise.
Well, I guess, you know, it's sort of a thing when I've read Elkin, when you blunder into an Elkin novel, say, You'll never forget you've been there. It's not self-deprecating the way Portis is. I know all sorts of people who read Portis and say, well, that was a funny little book. He doesn't insist on telling you that he's a brilliant writer. He has a nice fumbling way of brushing you aside when he's done with you.
Absolutely.
Whereas Elkin, to his credit, wants to grab you by the lapels, and he's going to, you know, howl and talk in your face.
That's right. I'm not quite going to do that. it's just not my personality. I mean, if one knew Stanley, he was doing that all the time to you when you talked to him. He was always kind of grabbing you by your lapels and talking to you. And Bud Portis, whom I know a little bit, as you say, not going to do that. His demeanor is more modest, and his fictional demeanor is somewhat more modest.
Now, unlike some of the Elkin heroes who've made themselves up and know they have, they announce, Ben Flesh does in the Franchiser, that they're Spielers, or the Dick Gibson show, it's a radio talk show host, and he knows that he's a voice in the dark, and he has to throw his voice, and there are ventriloquists in that book, too. Frank, your hero, Frank Bascom, doesn't speak of himself as self-invented, but he too is a person who's always making a whirlwind of talk. Some people have described him as cynical, and I don't find him cynical.
No way. They're cynical if they think so. He's not. You know, it's just imputing to something that they find in their own crap little souls. He's not cynical at all. In fact, there's a I guess it comes from psychoanalysis or from various 12-step programs that if you say you're not something, you immediately indict yourself as being the thing you say you're not. But Frank, who says that he is sort of fleeing from cynicism, fleeing from the beguilements of cynicism, he is. I mean, he's going toward, in my view anyway, and I just wrote it, affection, some opportunity to make a connection with other people, which is wholehearted. Somebody said in the Sports Writer that Frank's relationship with Vicky was so cynical because it was kind of morganatic. You know, she was more simple than he was, and that it really was it would never have been a relationship that would have worked. Wrong. It would have worked if they could have made it work. And so that to me is a kind of a Frank's complete hopefulness about life. But he's also not a stoop. He knows that a lot of things you feel you need to think twice about.
Well, it was odd because, you know, it seems to me that there's a difference of quality between being able to say fast, funny, mean things rapidly and being a cynic.
And being mean yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, cynics don't know sincerity when they see it. That's what I think cynics are. And Frank is a man who knows sincerity when he sees it.
Well, again, it struck me. I was talking to Ian Frazier, and he told me that having learned how to make people laugh in his book about family, he wanted to find what the heights, the apexes of sincerity that he could reach in writing, that this seemed to him to be, in a way, more valid business. In this book, Frank Bascom says that he's moving from synchronicity to continuity. And I wondered if you could end by talking a bit about the continuity he achieves.
Well, it's at the end of the book, he confronts a Jewish guy who's actually trying very hard out of his own religious tradition to create a sense of continuity, which he sees as basically historical in nature, that has to do with connections between other people and has to do with ignoring the kinds of things that might separate people. And basically he's kind of an idealist in a way, sort of a silly idealist in a way. And Frank feels, I think, in thinking him silly, that continuity is only available to you if you recognize that the world is totally made up of contingency. and that people are always going to be in the way that Emerson describes, islands away from each other, and that all you can do is make these connections, perhaps brief ones, perhaps even longer ones, but that continuity will always be a temporary condition, which is worth striving for.
Frank's own terms for these phenomena, he says that he's moving from his existence period to his permanence period.
Right.
And that seemed to me to be a very Walker Percy kind of concept, yes?
Well, I don't know. I never read that in Walker, but Walker was a writer, and I knew Walker and loved his work. Walker was a writer who really was trying to fashion up sort of almost ideational notions about the world to pass on to the reader. Not necessarily even that I think he believed it, but that he was via an affection for language, an affection for and having a conceptual mind, which he did and I don't. He was trying to offer the world something. You know, what in the movie Gore, he had these things called rotations, which he passed on to the reader to see if it fitted into their lives. And I think in some extent, Frank's trying to do that with the existence period. He's trying to describe a time in life which otherwise doesn't have a description. A time when people are happy, the big crises of your life are somewhat behind you, you're slightly unattached from certain things in your life, but not all the important things in your life. In other words, it's trying to sort of fly in the face of Tolstoy, who said happy families are all alike. I think he's trying to say there is something that fiction can do to describe a time in life which is more or less agreeable to you, and trying, you know, thereafter to wonder, as Frank does, whether or not this condition, the existence period, can last all the way to the end.
Lying in that same bed in which we heard him wincing, he thinks to himself that he's sorry that he's no longer a short story writer, and that the reason he's sorry is that there are so many things he thinks that would otherwise get lost.
Yeah.
What are the things that you most want to preserve?
You mean within this book or out?
Out.
Out. I think I'm always trying to write about people making some stab at affection. And that's what I'm constantly writing books in behalf of, in one variety or another, or with one degree of hopefulness or another. And not that the books are Pollyannish, but they would be affirming if they could. And so what I'm always trying to preserve is that within human beings, things that would cause you not to despair, things that would cause you not to think that the world is just contingent around you all the time, that a book can do that.
I've been speaking to Richard Ford on the publication of his new novel, Independence Day. Thank you very much for joining
me. It's a great treat to be here, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop time.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.